So far, it seems that when governments try to ban or restrict Bitcoin, it ends up merely accelerating the adoption of the currency inside their countries. Governments that have failed miserably with their wars on drugs may find stopping people from holding something that's invisible, borderless, and teleporting much more difficult. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up? I am Guy Swan. I love my little intro. This music gets me jacked. I am the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And this is Bitcoin Audible, where you get your doctorate in Bitcoin history, economics, and the technology, and you get to hear all of the best works in the space, all free of charge, simply because I'm a nerd, and it's what I want to do with my time. So we are reading Alex Gladstein's recent piece on Quillette, breaking down the ins and outs of whether the government can really ban Bitcoin. And it's a really awesome, concise piece on this topic. Another one that I highly recommend is The Government Can't Ban Bitcoin by Parker Lewis. I'll have that in the link, and I recommend a couple other ones later on in the show, and I'll have all those links available. But real quick, I want to say, awesome announcement that the Swan team, Swan with one N and Swan, my Swan with two N's, is back together. We have been chatting with the crew at Swan Bitcoin, the best place to auto buy and insta buy your Bitcoin savings. And they are going to bring Bitcoin Audible to you. It's where I buy Bitcoin. And it auto withdraws to my own keys. I literally do nothing. It happens automatically. It's like magic. And you know, when you get your Bitbox O2 for cold storage, makes the withdrawal even easier. You know, everyone here wants you to hold your own keys. This is critical. And we actually talk about in this article why that's so important. And these are just the easiest tools to make that happen securely. And then for your day-to-day financial life, our last sponsor, you get Bitcoin mobile banking with Level. Direct deposit, debit card, and the works, lvl.co. And you can check out all of these right now at guyswan, that's Swan with two N's, .com. Okay, but I got a really long guy's take for this one, but let's go ahead and get into today's amazing read and just a must listen. And it's titled, Can Governments Stop Bitcoin? By Alex Gladstein. Since its creation more than 12 years ago, Bitcoin is undefeated. Its price has leapt from $5 to $50 to $500 to $5,000 to now past $50,000. The number of global users has eclipsed 100 million. The system's network security, number of developers, and new applications are at all-time highs. Dozens of companies, including Tesla and Square, have started to add Bitcoin to their corporate treasuries. This worldwide success doesn't mean that people haven't tried to stop Bitcoin. The Digital Money Project has in fact survived a variety of attacks which in some cases threatened its existence. There are two main vectors: network attacks on the software and hardware infrastructure, and legal attacks on Bitcoin users. Before we explore them and consider why they failed, let's start at the beginning. In January 2009, a mysterious coder going by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto launched Bitcoin, an open-source financial network with big ambitions, to replace central banking with a decentralized peer-to-peer system with no rulers. It would use a programmable, highly fungible token that could be spent like electronic cash or saved like digital gold. It would be distributed around the world through a set-in-stone money-printing schedule to a subset of users who would compete to secure the network with energy and in return, get freshly minted Bitcoin. Initially, most were understandably skeptical, and very few paid attention. There had been attempts at creating, quote, e-cash before, and all had failed. No one had been able to figure out how to create a decentralized, incorruptible mint, or how to grow a system that couldn't be stopped by governments. But a small community grew around Bitcoin, which promised just that. Led by Satoshi and Hal Finney, this group of iconoclasts discussed, tinkered with, and improved the software in its first year, using their computers to mine 50 worthless Bitcoin every 10 minutes. Eventually, someone decided these virtual tokens were worth enough to accept in return for a real-world good. On May 22, 2010, a developer named Laszlo Hynek paid 10,000 Bitcoin for two Papa John's pizzas at an exchange rate of 0.1 cent per Bitcoin. No one could have predicted that Laszlo's pizza order would one day be so costly. Today, this order is worth more than $500 million. Since the early days of PC mining and the Silk Road, Bitcoin has become a global phenomenon. No one knows who Satoshi is, but if their creation was a company, it would be one of the world's top 10 most valuable. Its fan base has grown from a few pseudonyms on cypherpunk message boards to including the likes of Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, Tesla CEO Elon Musk, Harvard professor Neil Ferguson, Fidelity CEO Abby Johnson, actress Lindsay Lohan, singer Soulja Boy, skateboarder Tony Hawk, and investor Paul Tudor Jones. It has its own Unicode character, the Bitcoin Bee. An industry conference held this month focusing on how to add Bitcoin to corporate treasuries drew more than 6,000 companies. MIT boasts a research center contributing to long-term Bitcoin security. Bitcoin markets have popped up in virtually every country and major urban area on Earth, with local traders eager to buy Bitcoin in exchange for local currency everywhere from Caracas to Manila to Moscow. Millions of people in Nigeria, Argentina, Iran, Cuba, and beyond are now using Bitcoin to escape their local currency system and opt into something with a better track record as a store of value than the Naira, Bolivar, Real, or Peso. They can control their Bitcoin with a private key, think password, and they can store it on a phone, USB stick, on paper, or even with memorized word lists, and send the currency to family or friends anywhere on Earth in minutes, with no permission from any authority required. The mainstream media typically portrays Bitcoin as a penny stock gone wild, or a new kind of digital tulip mania. But the reality is, Bitcoin is a political project that threatens to fundamentally disrupt the Davos-led economic system, with everyone from Janet Yellen to Christine Lagarde expressing fear about its rise and demanding it be regulated. Governments retain their power in part by issuing and controlling money. Bitcoin is a new model that mints and secures money without governments. So the big question is, why haven't governments or megacorps stopped it? And if they try to attack Bitcoin in the near future, what would that look like? There is an enormous amount of speculation on the internet about how Bitcoin might be attacked, but few stop to think about why it hasn't already been destroyed. The answer is that there are political and economic incentives for more and more people to push the system forward and strengthen its security, and strong political, economic, and technical disincentives that discourage attacks. Certainly, Bitcoin isn't too small to draw the attention of governments. Previous attempts at parallel online digital currencies like eGold and Liberty Reserve were shut down by the US government before even making it to $10 billion in market capitalization. Bitcoin now has a market cap north of $1 trillion. Every day Bitcoin survives, it becomes stronger, and for many attack vectors, the windows are rapidly closing. One reason that Bitcoin is so tenacious is that it is a globally distributed phenomenon. The vast majority of mining takes place outside of the US in China and Central Asia. but the vast majority of Bitcoin holders and buyers appear to be in the US and EU entities. And the software's core developers and node runners who host Bitcoin servers are scattered throughout the world. The most important person in Bitcoin, its inventor, is no longer relevant and could even be dead. Coding, mining, infrastructure, and markets are all independent, happening in competing jurisdictions and geopolitical rivals, often done by anonymous or pseudonymous actors, all with different philosophies and goals, but with one uniting motivation: to keep Bitcoin going. Unlike every other cryptocurrency, there is no central point of failure. Bitcoin has no Vitalik Buterin, no Ethereum Foundation, no Deltec Bank like Tether, no fancy offices in San Francisco, no team of lawyers, no governance token, no VC backing, no pre-mine, no small council, and no whales able to manipulate the system. This decentralized architecture has already insulated Bitcoin from attacks at the highest levels. No matter how much Bitcoin you own, you can't change the rules, print more, censor, steal, or prevent others from using the network. Arguably the most powerful financial force in the world, the US government, led by then-Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, just launched an attack on Bitcoin in December 2020. It was not a particularly strong one, but still an attack nonetheless, which would have forced US exchanges to gather more information about individuals withdrawing their Bitcoin to wallets they control than even mainstream banks collect, handing the surveillance state much more intricate knowledge of Bitcoin's flow of funds. But the crackdown failed, stymied by a broad coalition of opposition, and Mnuchin is now gone. The new US regulatory regime might be less aggressive. In fact, incoming SEC Chairman Gary Gensler once taught a class about Bitcoin. Cynthia Lummis, a freshly elected senator from Wyoming and passionate Bitcoin supporter, has been named to the Senate Banking Committee. That means one of the most powerful bodies in the US financial system now sports a member who recently tweeted about Bitcoin, quote, "I came for the store of value, I stayed for the censorship resistance." Lummis joins Warren Davidson and others in Congress who have vowed to defend Bitcoin. The biggest attack in Bitcoin's history came in 2017 at the software level. That spring, a handful of the most important industry actors gathered and signed what is called the New York Agreement. The authors boasted more than 83% of the global mining hash power, more than 50 total companies, more than 20 million wallets, and a huge share of the payment infrastructure. It was an alliance between Chinese miners, Silicon Valley, and Wall Street, and their goal was to change Bitcoin to allow it to process more transactions per second at the cost of sacrificing decentralization and the ability of users to audit the monetary supply from home. Despite the odds, a handful of grassroots activists ended up building a movement that stunningly defeated this New York alliance. By November 2017, the corporate, quote, SegWit2x plan was dead, and Bitcoin remained decentralized. The lesson from these scaling wars is that neither miners nor corporations control Bitcoin. Yes, miners process transactions, and developers propose upgrades to the software, but tens of thousands of users running nodes actually decide what transactions are valid and what software version is adopted. Even if a government took control of a majority of the Bitcoin hash rate, this doesn't enable them to change the Bitcoin consensus rules, or print more Bitcoin, or steal anyone's holdings. The worst they could do is use their power to mine new versions of Bitcoin, which in the case of BCH or BSV has failed spectacularly, or burn billions of dollars to temporarily damage the network in what's called a 51% attack. In such an attack, a majority of miners could team up and use their superior hash rate to momentarily overwhelm the network. The price of the hardware required would exceed $5 billion. Even if a government did want to risk that much on such an exotic assault, It is unlikely that they would divert the precious fabrication capacity of the world's few semiconductor manufacturers to this very speculative purpose. For China or the US, disrupting existing semiconductor orders during a global shortage could put national security at stake. An alternative would be to seize a majority of the world's mining equipment in a military operation. But the logistics of trying to locate and violently capture hundreds of thousands of five-pound machines owned by often pseudonymous actors across dozens of jurisdictions would be hugely prohibitive. Speculation about other technical attacks on Bitcoin abounds. Mining pools, censoring transactions. Miners make more money from not censoring, can quickly switch to non-censoring pools, and may adopt software that makes censorship impossible. A global internet shutdown could be disruptive, but not fatal. Mining hardware backdoors. This actually happened, but was not exploited, and the threat is now fading. Quantum computers breaking Bitcoin's cryptography. Not to be taken seriously, according to experts. And even bad actors making harmful updates to the codebase. This wouldn't stand a chance against hundreds of watchful developers. The fact is, despite constant fear-mongering about how Bitcoin could fail, all users have always been able to transact. There have been no significant acts of censorship. Attempts to disrupt the protocol or the network infrastructure would be incredibly difficult and costly to attempt and have no guarantee of success. As we saw in 2017, even if powers are able to amass a supermajority of the hash rate, they could be defeated by the network's decentralized architecture. Far easier and far more likely are attacks on users themselves. There are several nightmare scenarios that Bitcoiners fear that don't involve science fiction around governments teaming up in a Mission Impossible style mission to seize billions of dollars of energy and mining equipment. One such fear is four numbers, 6102. In 1933, the FDR administration passed Executive Order 6102, which banned citizens from holding gold and forced them to turn in any gold to the authorities. The U.S. government or any other government could try doing the same, giving citizens a window to declare and sell their Bitcoin to the government, or else face jail time. The Bitcoin community is already preparing for such an attack. One reason 6102 was so successful is that the government could just go to banks who held gold on behalf of citizens and seize at point of custody. So every January 3rd, users celebrate Proof of Keys Days, where it is customary to withdraw any Bitcoin they own on exchanges or in the custody of third parties to wallets that the end users control. Not your keys, not your coins, first popularized by Bitcoin educator Andreas Antonopoulos, is a community mantra. With more than 10% of the American population using Bitcoin, if enough people self-custody, then a 6102 attack would be of limited effect. Given that the keys to your Bitcoin account are typically in the form of 24 seed words that can be written down, hidden, encoded, or memorized, a military home-by-home raid couldn't work very well and would constitute a mass set of human rights violations. Another regulatory threat would be a new unrealized gains tax on Bitcoin, which would be devastating to long-term savers, or new strict know-your-customer rules, making it a crime to buy Bitcoin through an unauthorized issuer. But such rules have many obstacles. First and Fourth Amendment protections, numerous senators and congressmen pushing for a more Bitcoin-inclusive policy, and a large and growing cryptocurrency industry that would vigorously lobby against such rules. Governments could try to marginalize Bitcoin by introducing a competitor, a central bank digital currency. Most central banks worldwide are experimenting with the idea of replacing banknotes with digital tokens that citizens could hold in mobile wallets. One argument that promoters of these systems make is that they could help check the thirst for Bitcoin. Ultimately, however, CBDCs like China's DCEP can't compete because their floating global price will be tied to the existing fiat currency, which will inevitably fall in relative purchasing power. Meanwhile, Bitcoin's purchasing power continues to rise over time, and it offers a level of transactional freedom and privacy from the state that no CBDC could ever boast. Another attack vector could be a ban on the act of Bitcoin mining itself inside democracies. Today, many mainstream media articles describe Bitcoin as an environmental disaster. In reality, it relies heavily on renewable energy. Estimates range from 39% to 74%, consumes a lot of stranded or excess energy, and could very well have a mostly green future. But given the poorly informed narratives around the subject, one could imagine a world in which the Biden administration restricts Bitcoin mining as part of a Green New Deal. The quote, "two Bitcoin problem" is perhaps the biggest existing threat to Bitcoin users today. If the top 25 global exchanges in the US, EU, and East Asia agreed to end user withdrawals, then that would effectively bifurcate the system. Bitcoin inside the bubble would be whitelisted, and Bitcoin outside could be blacklisted. Meaning, if a merchant accepts Bitcoin from you that is not on a certain list, they'd be running a risk. No matter how private you are with your Bitcoin, it wouldn't matter. You'd need to find people willing to accept your Bitcoin with no trail. Such laws would force users into peer-to-peer markets, where buyers don't care about coin history. Even still, there are lots of barriers to this attack. Exchanges would lose millions of customers and billions of dollars of business. The quote, "DeFi ecosystem" would potentially collapse, given it relies on users being able to purchase ETH with dollars on big exchanges and then withdraw to trading platforms like Uniswap. Companies in this space would vigorously resist any change that would prevent citizens from withdrawing Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency to self-controlled wallets. As these examples show, there are plenty of kinds of regulatory attacks that should concern Bitcoin users, and they are much more likely than cryptographic or hash rate attacks on the network. But the reality is that many legal attacks have already happened, and they have been ineffective. In 2017, the Chinese Communist Party restricted the ability of its citizens to exchange RMB for Bitcoin. Shortly thereafter, the Indian government did the same, followed by the Pakistani government and several others. In other words, the two largest governments in the world tried to cut off Bitcoin access to their citizenry at the most obvious point, the on- and off-ramps where citizens exchange local currency for Bitcoin through exchanges. Last year, the Indian Supreme Court reversed this rule, and Bitcoin is no longer restricted. The government is again seeking to pass a bill prohibiting Bitcoin and all non-state cryptocurrencies, while also launching a digital currency to be issued by the Reserve Bank of India. But in the meantime, local usage grows. In China, after the 2017 restrictions, some companies moved to other countries in East Asia, but continued to do business with Chinese customers. Two of the biggest exchanges for the Chinese market, Huobi and OKCoin, still service millions of Chinese. In Pakistan, Bitcoin is de facto banned, but adoption is exploding. In Nigeria, the government is currently promising to freeze the bank accounts of any citizens who are identified as buying or selling Bitcoin. This regime has tried similar tactics before, but all have failed. What these actions actually accomplish is to drive citizens into harder-to-control peer-to-peer markets and into the arms of risk-tolerant entrepreneurs committed to helping their fellow citizens access a better financial system. In the United States, the recent last-minute attack by Secretary Mnuchin aside, American financial activity is increasingly monitored under laws like the Bank Secrecy Act. In line with this trend, cryptocurrency exchanges have introduced more stringent identification requirements for their customers, as well as increasingly small withdrawal limits. So far, though, Americans are still easily able to buy Bitcoin and withdraw it to wallets they control, and this will be defended by new powerful allies. Senator Loomis and Congressmen Davidson, McHenry, Emmer, and Soto as well as state leaders like Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, have all come out in support of Bitcoin, whether by hosting the white paper on their websites, promising to fend off overly restrictive regulation, or pledging to make their jurisdictions hotspots for Bitcoin entrepreneurial activity and innovation. Mayor Suarez, for example, is pushing for employees of the city of Miami to earn a percentage of their salary in Bitcoin, for residents to be able to pay taxes in Bitcoin, and to include Bitcoin as part of the city's investment portfolio. Some argue that corporate America will try to attack Bitcoin, but so far it seems that big companies are instead trying to join the party. In the past few months, Tesla, MicroStrategy, Square, Grayscale, and others are buying up billions of dollars more Bitcoin than the amount being produced through mining. And as savvy investors will realize, ultimately you can't separate Bitcoin from its cypherpunk nature. Bitcoin is only valuable as an asset because of its decentralization, since no one can arbitrarily change its rules or decide to print more. Driven by self-interest, Wall Street may ironically end up being one of the biggest cheerleaders of this new technology that Washington can't control. So far, it seems that when governments try to ban or restrict Bitcoin, it ends up merely accelerating the adoption of the currency inside their countries. Governments that have failed miserably with their wars on drugs may find stopping people from holding something that is invisible, borderless, and teleporting much more difficult. In democracies, governments will face major obstacles from the tech and financial industries, but also from the fact that restrictions on Bitcoin ownership can clash with free speech, privacy, and private property protections. Confiscation will require brutality, and it's not clear that all governments have the stomach or ability. Why would a government attack Bitcoin if it could gain more from using its energy monopoly or ability to print fiat to buy some? The rich and powerful will always design systems that benefit them before everyone else. The genius of Bitcoin is to take advantage of that very base reality and force them to get involved and help run the system instead of attacking it. In a world with friendly US regulators, rogue regimes mining Bitcoin to print dollars, and citizens of the world demanding an asset that can't be inflated away, the incentive to attack Bitcoin is dwindling. In the end, the only way to kill Bitcoin may be to make it so that people don't need it anymore. If no one wants a devaluation-proof, censorship-resistant, permissionless, borderless, non-discriminatory, teleporting financial asset, then no one will feed it energy, and it will die. Perhaps humanity can come up with another technology that addresses these needs. But until then, Bitcoin will thrive. All right, let's take a quick break, and then I want to get into a little guy's take on this piece. The economy will have to shift to a better, more reliable monetary foundation in order to get us out of this extraordinary mess. Why not get a head start and switch to your own Bitcoin standard with Level.co LVL Bitcoin mobile banking services? They are a free exchange with direct deposit, wire and ACH transfers, checks, and debit card. And that's in the free version. For just $9 a month, you get even more, a world debit card, personal banker to chat with, and even more benefits. They are in 28 states right now, and you can check out if you are one of the lucky mofos living in one at guyswan.com/level. And they are planning to make their way to the rest of the U.S., except New York, by the end of this year, so stay tuned. That is level.co mobile banking services at guyswan.com/level. Why are you wasting time? Start living in a Bitcoin-denominated future today. All right, quick shout out to Alex Gladstein, the author of this piece. He is Chief Strategy Officer at the Human Rights Foundation, and Just an awesome guy. You got to be following Alex if you are not. He's a serious and incredibly thoughtful and well-versed Bitcoiner, as well as just a huge advocate for liberties and human rights and, you know, electronic liberties, liberties in the internet and digital age. So huge shout out to him. He's at Gladstein on Twitter if you are not following him. But one of the things that I think is really critical, particularly for people who, you know, who are newer to the space to understand, is some of the main reasons and like attack vectors that we have seen in Bitcoin's past and what they were, like the significance of them. That's why I hope, you know, yesterday's episode with Brady Swenson and Peter Todd kind of enlightened a lot of that if you hadn't heard about some of that Bitcoin history. But the section in this quote, the biggest attack in Bitcoin's history came in 2017 at the software level. And I would actually argue that this was in the political, this was actually a social attack as well. So it was a social attack vector that was attempting to be implemented at the software level. But, you know, whatever, just a little clarification there. That spring, a handful of the most important industry actors gathered and signed what is called the New York Agreement. The authors boasted more than 83% of the global mining hash power, more than 50 total companies, more than 20 million wallets, and a huge share of the payment infrastructure. It was an alliance between Chinese miners, Silicon Valley, and Wall Street, and their goal was to change Bitcoin to allow it to process more transactions per second at the cost of sacrificing decentralization and the ability of users to audit the monetary supply from home. Now, this is a pretty solid paragraph of just covering the main ideas of the conflict in the scaling wars. Even though, like, there's a lot of nuances to it, that this was really about forking the consensus code when there was not agreement to do so, just in its nature. But the reason why, essentially kicking the can down the road at that point, which was so insignificant in the context of the scaling protocol, in the context of scaling this for payments, but so unbelievably significant in the context of who controls consensus. So that trade-off of allowing that then was basically setting in stone that this conglomerate was going to be able to change things as they saw fit in the future, particularly their attitude about it. Holy crap, the arrogance was phenomenal. And I just really love that Alex covers this kind of short version of the scaling wars, because as many have said, this was the most bullish moment in Bitcoin's history for a lot of people in the space who care about the game theory, who care about the decentralization and independence of the Bitcoin protocol itself. The amount of backing that the New York Agreement had was really kind of nerve-wracking. You know, there was an element of like, shit, they're going to run this thing. Like it was pretty scary. And they were actively saying that they were going to attack the minority chain and that this wasn't going to be a fork because they were going to obliterate any minority that thought that they were going to break off and not allow them to alter the rules, and that they were going to decimate it, that they were not going to allow it to split and for another fork to exist. They were going to be the dominant because they had 83% of the hash power, and screw anyone. They were going to do basically replay attacks where they would execute transactions on both chains at once. They weren't going to protect the new chain or the old chain from the new chain's transactions. So any broadcast on either chain was going to broadcast on both chains. And then they stated in multiple conversations, a handful of the main actors in this whole debacle, that they were going to fire. They were going to eliminate and kick out of the entire space the many developers that were uncooperative. So everybody who was basically putting up a voice against this, Because this is a decentralized system, and what do you know, it was a contentious change that they were literally going to be quote unquote fired. And this would essentially, if this had actually worked, what they were doing is they were moving the entire the client base to a new GitHub and commit authority that they then controlled. Because if everybody forked onto their client and they could get all the exchanges and miners and major payment processors and stuff on board, which they basically did, well, then they would have full control over the reference client. And if there was ever contention again, they could just kick people out and shut down the discussion because they would be the authority. This was them trying to take it over. And even if their supposed change was minor, the fundamental change was that now they were going to run the client and they were going to kick out all of the developers who did not agree with them. And this was not implicit. This was not a suggestion that somebody made up. They explicitly stated this is what they were going to do, and they did so while beating their chest like they had the justification to do this. This was literally a takeover that they just justified because they subjectively desired it, that it was worth it, and then therefore they were the heroes. They completely believed they were, but they were attempting to hijack the entire network. And this was obviously despite the fact that there was a massive swath of users, developers, and the community and businesses around the space that were not happy with this change and thought the trade-off was way, way too big for essentially no effective gain. And they essentially had a who's who of the mining and exchange industry on board with this deal. You know, it wasn't just something that you could brush this off. This was a big deal. The fact that the user activated soft fork won out in the game theory, and that this was openly discussed on Reddit for months and months. Like, it wasn't like this was like a hidden thing where like we didn't know what was involved, or like, you know, somebody got a one up on all these big corporations like over Coinbase and all the miners or whatever. No, we just said, like, if we hold out, they inevitably lose, and they are reading these conversations just like we were. Ultimately, the users running the nodes define what the network consensus is, because they are literally what allow users and exchanges to even communicate in the first place. So the current makeup of nodes, of the economic nodes, everybody who is actually a meaningful person on the network, they define the current state of the blockchain. And that means they define the rules that anybody who wants to participate must adhere to. You know, nobody wants to mine. Mining is just a huge cost to getting Bitcoin and transacting and all of this stuff. The reason they mine is because the node network demands that there be a hash on the block or it is not valid. They are doing it to please the nodes, not to please each other. They're doing it to please the network because the network will not allow them to participate without following the consensus rules. And the new NYA supporters and the big blockers, so to speak, literally like got so angry. I mean, everybody was angry. The whole thing was vicious. But just squealed about Bitcoin wasn't going to have any blocks. They were going to attack it. They were going to run it into the ground. Good luck with your 10% of the hash power. We're going to absolutely destroy you. And we just said, okay, we'll wait. It's like, well, it pissed people off so bad. The screaming, just, you can't wait. Your chain is going to be trash. You won't be able to transact, blah, blah, blah. You won't be able to do anything. It's like, okay, we'll wait. We'll have 6-hour blocks and we will just wait. But you will not install malicious code on our nodes. We're just not going to do it. And that was basically the whole thing. We were calling their bluff. It's like, if the nodes don't run the network, then piss off. Go do your own thing. Change Bitcoin. Good luck. We are not going to install your client. Period. The game theory there is really rather simple. Users do not have costs outside of just a basic time cost in holding out. Right? We just wait around. You know, there have been times where there have been 2 hours between a block. Okay. It doesn't cost me anything. I'll just hang on. I'm not going to go rush to some website of somebody I don't trust running some code that I think is malicious and install it on my client because I got 2 hour blocks. Who cares? Wait half a year. And I'm happy to bet that the miners will come back to the original chain when they find out that none of their transactions can interact with any of the users, because the bulk of the users, because there's a huge user barrier running nodes that does not let their blocks or their transactions propagate our network. So miners run the risk of not being able to send their coins anywhere because they're mining under a false set of consensus rules, and then potentially have to sell them at a steep loss because nobody is accepting them on their network. Nobody will withdraw those crappy coins. Nobody's going to buy those coins because they're running full nodes and they can tell the difference. It's just a fork, like the thousands and thousands of other forks on the network, in the cryptocurrency space. And that's what it was. That's what it is to change the consensus rules when you don't have consensus. You have a shitcoin fork. This was by far the largest, most coordinated attack on Bitcoin to date. The self-important, quote-unquote, industry leaders, as they thought themselves to be, considered that they could speak for everyone, even when they were disagreeing with them. It was truly a political attack. And this is why there is still so much butthurt, even from today, from the likes of like Coinbase and others, because they failed so spectacularly. And worst of all is that had this actually succeeded, they would have been solely responsible for the most embarrassing technical failure of Bitcoin in its entirety, in its entire history. The quote-unquote SegWit2x client, which is the one that they were doing, which with the hilariously ironic goal of firing the uncooperative developers, had a developer bug, and it never produced a block. So all of their nodes and miners who tried to go ahead with the fork, even after it lost most of its support and a lot of the major players backed out and said they weren't going to do it, which was like a week before it was supposed to happen. There were still a subset of people who tried to mine it and tried to run it, and miners who, stayed on that network, stayed on that client, and they just sat in limbo. They were just waiting for a block with code that had the wrong block height number in it. It sat completely dead for hours before basically everybody just shut down and went back to the original client. So it turns out the years and probably 10,000 or 100,000 tweets and Reddit comments of over and over of, it's just a few lines of code, it's just changing a number, it's a tiny little nothing, there's nothing going to go wrong, you're blowing the risks up as if it's way bigger than it is, was in fact still an incredibly dangerous and idiotic thing to do, as was said over and over and over again. And luckily, all they did was embarrass themselves and not Bitcoin. And this also proved that ultimately, as long as individual users can run full nodes and defend themselves against consensus attacks, then collectively they can defend against any attempt to change the network by essentially evicting anybody who is working against consensus. All the attackers are by default evicted from the network, and all the users have to do is not install malicious hardware malicious software that they don't trust. Period. That's it. And they just wait. Understand, the network and its value is the very people who are part of it. If you can't interact with those people or their network, then their stupid fork isn't worth anything. It's like saying that, all of the pants makers are going to declare that the only thing you're allowed to buy are bright red jeans. And all the customers say, yeah, I'm not coming into your store until you have blue jeans. And then the shops thinking that if they simply only put red jeans on their shelves, that that oh well now customers will be forced to buy red jeans. It's like, well, no, the customers don't have to buy jeans. They can just sit around and wait till somebody opens a store with blue jeans. And the idea, you'll hear actually a lot of like B-cashers and big blockers say that, oh, that can be Sybil attacked. Well, the equivalent of a Sybil attack would be making 20,000 sock puppets on Twitter say, red jeans are the best. I love red jeans. But still, if you go to the store, nobody's in there buying red jeans because it's all 20,000 sock puppets that aren't actually buying or want red jeans. It's fake. If all the real users, if all the real customers simply refuse to go in until they can buy blue jeans, the gig is up. The businesses have a huge cost. The businesses have to keep clothes on the floor. And if they don't have customers come in, they go out of business, just like miners. And this is an open, permissionless network in which that dynamic exists, and all of the users can verify without question that, or essentially evict anyone who doesn't sell them the jeans they ask for. That if they're not blue jeans, I'm sorry, but you just don't get to talk to me. I will never come in your store. Then the ever worsening disasters of Bcash and BSV only basically cemented it further as the years have gone on. And this is also a critical reason why network level attacks are so ineffectual. The scaling, the consequences of the scaling debate. So the bandwidth needed to maintain consensus at the network level because of the block size limit is small enough that it can route around any blockade, any network blockade or barriers on the internet. Hell, Blockstream is broadcasting the entire blockchain from the Genesis block. You can sync a node with a satellite dish and no internet connection. And that's to almost the entire surface of the planet. And they're using old television bands. The ability to do that and the ability to defend the network with a full node consensus barrier would be essentially eliminated with as simple as 10 megabyte, 20 megabyte blocks. Like if a lot of nodes went offline, after a couple of years of that, getting actually recovering the network and getting those nodes back online would take months. Like it would take months of trying to compute and get back in consensus. And slowly and surely, as time went on, the only inevitable result would be more and more centralized as time went on. And there's as soon as you cross that barrier where you've reached a point where it will only get slightly more centralized, even if it's only like 1% more centralized every year, like some nodes go off and it gets centered into one jurisdiction or another or whatever. If the trend is what matters. If the trend remains toward greater centralization because it's getting harder and harder and harder to run a node, then it doesn't matter if it takes 20 years to really get there in an effective way such that the network can be dominated. It's going to get there. It just does. There's no escaping it. And there is a point where if you just allow it to happen, there's no going back. You can't fix it. That is why the block size did not get raised. That is why the community came to its defense. In fact, it's harder to run a node now than it was a couple of years ago. And that's with such a restrictive block size limit. It'll still be a few years before we basically go over the hill. It plateaus out and then finally starts to fall again. So we still, luckily, it's, even though it's getting slightly worse every year and we've seen a decline in full nodes, it's also it's getting worse at a smaller and smaller rate, and it will turn back around to the point that nodes get easier to run with time. It just will take quite a while. So that's why Luke Dasher actually has proposed making the blocks smaller, because you can soft fork in a restriction of the rules. You have to hard fork in an expansion of the rules. So within the consensus rules, we could technically make the blocks smaller and really pump up the fee market and basically kick us off into the third economic era, as Rusty Russell would say, the three economic eras of Bitcoin. Really great piece if you haven't heard it. I kick us off into that phase of things really quickly, or go ahead and basically bite the bullet and get it done. But of course, it's not feasible. So we got the best that we could work with. And luckily, I think we defended Bitcoin from a really, really serious disaster, basically a precedent that would have ultimately led to its death, probably, or at least in the promise of a user-controlled, permissionless global system. Now, being banned. So our government's going to ban it. This is another interesting point. And I find it odd that this actually continues to be true, even in the larger countries that have banned it. And it's that Bitcoin increases in price when it is banned. Now, there's typically just the news of it will typically cause a short-term price dip. But over the long term, the longer it sustains, it almost always develops a pretty significant premium in those countries because it gets pushed into peer-to-peer markets. And what's funny is as the economic incentives to use or need something like Bitcoin is only made stronger if you ban it, because that, like, a ban on Bitcoin is literally the definition of capital controls, right? And the only reason you would do it is because you're basically, you know, that government's currency is at risk, or there's capital flight or whatever. And the very need, the very economic incentive to use Bitcoin as opposed to that currency is only present when they basically make that currency more restrictive, when they make it harder to move stuff, when they put people at greater risk with excessive KYC regulation and restrictions on how much you can move and how much you can take out of the country, et cetera, et cetera. So it actually worsens the very economic incentives that make Bitcoin such a powerful tool to begin with. So it actually works against them, that ban. And I just think it's kind of funny that it seems to certainly be the case that it just gets pushed in peer markets, that the whack-a-mole game of trying to attack all the Bitcoiners is too difficult to sustain, or at least largely ineffective, and that it really doesn't have a massive long-term effect in those countries, and that adoption continues to grow. And he's got a couple of links to, you know, like, Pakistan and how, like, adoption has been growing in Pakistan, even though it's basically been banned, how Chinese customers continue to get served heavily, even across the Chinese border, and that there's so many miners in China as well, despite all of this. And, you know, it's in their incentive to allow their, like the hydroelectric projects and stuff to make, they're making a killing off of having these miners available, particularly during when they can basically consume all of the wasted and excess energy in these renewable systems that don't always have an available customer. And this is what we talk about with wasted or stranded or inaccessible energy, and the fact that Bitcoin is such an incredibly powerful tool because it's independent of any, like, spatial restriction. Because the bandwidth requirements are so low that it basically doesn't need a fiber internet connection to work. It doesn't have to be turned on at noon and can't be used at midnight. You know, it doesn't have a temporal restrictions. Like the energy source is simply when the energy is needed, it can be piped into Bitcoin mining, and proof of work is a quote unquote, what was it? The decentralized clock piece was so good. It's a progressless. Every single proof of work is equal to all proof of work, right? Is that, like, you don't have to, it's not a problem that you paused for 3 hours when you didn't have excess energy and then you turned it back on. And it doesn't even matter that you don't broadcast a non-solution to the network, or that even anybody knows that you are mining to begin with. As long as you broadcast the solution, it's always net positive to take wasted energy and turn it into a proof of work. That's a really, really powerful incentive that's hard to simply shut down. Again, the economics is very strong in Bitcoin's favor here. And, you know, so the realistic government attack that I think Alex touches on really well in this is the slow encroaching government attack. And I think this is how it is likely to be attacked. It could be the other way. And honestly, I think maybe it would be better for Bitcoin in the long run if there was kind of some aggressive attacks against it, to be perfectly honest. As I say, Bitcoin is anti-fragile. Therefore, the more aggressive its detractors or opponents, the more likely it is that we build the tools and focus all of our efforts, the Bitcoiners themselves, the cypherpunks, focus all of their efforts on eliminating those attack vectors. So while they are minor attack vectors that aren't a huge concern, it's very easy to just procrastinate or push the can, like just not worry about it right now. But if a minor concern is turned into a pretty significant concern because somebody starts to try to, like a large government or something tries to really attack that specific element of it, or squeeze their way through the crack in that particular attack vector, is exactly what makes everyone build the tools, the secondary protocols, the better hash protocols and standards and these sorts of things that route around or obsolete those very attack vectors. And I think that's the most powerful resource in Bitcoin, is its anti-fragile nature and the fact that the economic incentives get everyone on board around finding and building all of the solutions. And ultimately, it's software, right? There's a solution to everything. I mean, shit, Bitcoin was a solution to a massive societal problem that was perceived as impossible. And what do you know? There was a software solution. And it has sucked up the mind share, the greatest mind share in the world of people who can defend and create robust distributed systems against, in the face of powerful adversaries. Like, If there is a place where you want someone to be able to build a system like that or build a solution to exactly that sort of problem, it's in Bitcoin, right? Like, you go to this industry in order to find all of the people who are brilliant at all of those exact things. But realistically, I that's part of the reason why I actually think they won't, like, this won't be kind of the way it plays out. I see the baby steps, the more realistic and more common baby steps of governments saying, I'm going to be friendly, but then I'm going to be restrictive. Two steps forward, one step back, and they just encroach one little unfriendly or inconvenient law or legislation or whatever at a time. That's how they creep in control over tons of other industries, right? At least it's typically the way, at least in the US. That's kind of the United States way, is the crony, slow, backdoor takeover of industries. They like to corrupt an industry or market and make it almost wholly government-run and subsidized and controlled. And then they use the increasing failures of that market, now that they're micromanaging it, as the evidence that the free market is failing and therefore they should have more control. So it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, is the more control they take over it, the shittier the industry is and the more problems there are, and therefore it justifies the fact that we didn't spend enough money on it the first time. I mean, shit, look at healthcare, education, finance, the judicial system, energy sector. Like, I mean, all of it. Like, if you had to name the things that healthcare, if you had to name the industries that are most controlled by government, like, that's the list. That's it. And they're also the ones where we have the greatest systemic problems and huge imbalances and forever increasing prices and complete lack of the normal person to afford it. And of course, that's the very excuse that the government has to write another 10,000 page piece of legislation that nobody's ever going to be able to make sense of, so that they have even more control and direct even more within the industry. Rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. So I'd expect a similar tactic in Bitcoin. Case in point, a recent example is the it was like a North American mining pool thing. It was like a proposal that I saw that was basically suggested that there should be a legally sanctioned mining pool that is like for the United States and like North America in general. Like I think Canada was going to be involved in this or something. And I think this is still on the table, by the way. I don't think anything has happened with it, but this is an approach that makes sense to me from that sort of idea. And that all the miners would be KYC'd, but because they're all part of this, you know, quote unquote, legitimate whitelisted, you know, huge mining pool, they would basically be in a legal agreement with the government that they could only mine, you know, quote unquote, approved transactions. And this would lead to the idea that Alex laid out here of the two Bitcoin problem that I think is the most realistic potential outcome here that would be a negative for overall negative for Bitcoin's future. The natural trade-off of Bitcoin's transparency, which protects its monetary supply and consensus rules, actually becomes the most significant hurdle for its privacy and censorship resistance, because you can effectively store blacklist certain addresses. Luckily, again, I think the game theory here still works in our favor. Not only will major economic actors who get involved benefit massively from essentially, quote, helping Bitcoin rather than fighting it, but as fees become the dominant mining reward rather than newly issued Bitcoin, even a small premium in the privacy-seeking transactions or the quote-unquote blacklisted Bitcoin blocks or transactions or mixing protocols or whatever, which inherently are aggregators, so it could actually be more economically efficient while at the same time having a premium on the fees, they could actually result in a very significant profit difference. That's less likely to be the case while the newly issued Bitcoin is the dominant reward. But when fees become the dominant reward, thanks to Bitcoin's deflationary schedule, that no longer is the case. And we enter into a phase where even if only a handful of blocks get in per day by darknet miners, quote unquote, the margin on those will continue to be higher and higher than the approved blocks. So the huge cost in trying to orphan every single one of those will only actually worsen that cost, because they effectively lower their own real hash rate in doing so. Because in a sense, they would be like, if 20% of the miners on the network are trying to mine these blacklisted transactions and getting higher reward for doing so, what the whitelisted miners are effectively doing is decreasing their effectiveness and the realistic hash power of the network by 20%, while also giving up on this premium in the privacy-seeking transactions. So if something like that did become a significant problem, not only would developers and the cypherpunks and Bitcoiners immediately the absolute top concern would be privacy. Everything that was built would be 100% focused on privacy. But I just kind of think in general, we have kind of some half examples in Bitcoin's past as to how this might unfold. And I think it would be kind of a combination of what happened with Ghash.io and then also the Ant Bleed attack. So Alex Gladstein actually referenced Ant Bleed early in the article, talking about how there were backdoors into mining hardware. So Bitmain, who was actually pushing really hard and doing everything they could to stop SegWit and force that SegWit2x fork, the NYA that we were talking about, New York Agreement, onto the network, they built a secret backdoor into all of the mining hardware that they sold so that they could remotely shut them down. And when it was discovered, And then admitted by them that SegWit, which they were dead set against, was actually going to obsolete a significant advantage that they had had with a patented hidden code. So aside from the back door that they installed, they had a patent on ASIC boost, on covert ASIC boost, which basically meant they could get like a 15% advantage over everybody else in the network, and nobody would know that they were utilizing that 15% advantage. And if SegWit got implemented, well, then it would make that obsolete. They wouldn't be able to do it anymore unless they refused to mine any SegWit transactions in their blocks. So this basically outed their real intention for attempting to force a fork on the network, and why they were so against SegWit. And we're just making up things like, oh, you could just steal SegWit coins and blah, 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 and all this just nonsense. They basically had a secret advantage over the entire network and a copyright claim on that advantage, and they did not want to give that up. But the backlash was pretty glorious, and they essentially walked back a lot of what they were doing. It killed their reputation for everybody except Bcashers, who were convinced that Core was the devil, and basically everyone who did not want to fork the network to their consensus rules was a evil sock puppet, I guess. But they were not able to force a change that, you know, their minority community wanted on the network. And that's what happened, right? You know, if you ever, like, hear the other side of the tale, understand the absolute fundamental thing that happened was that they were attempting to force and wanted a contentious, consensus-breaking change on the network, and they could not get enough people to install it. They'll tell you that means that somebody else hijacked the network, but what it means is that they failed to hijack the network. Nothing within the current consensus rules is hijacking. The current consensus rules are the current consensus rules, and nobody ever changed those consensus rules. SegWit wasn't a change to the consensus rules. That's why we weren't against SegWit. But anyway, not to go back to the whole scaling debate thing mess. Then there was the Ghash.io episode. So first, it destroyed Bitmain's reputation, and Bitcoiners just, you know, the hornets descended, right? This was when basically that side of the community was being established. It's gotten pretty epic ever since. But then there was the Ghash.io episode, where a mining pool, Ghash, was simply so successful that it had over 51% of the hash rate by itself. And basically the community freaked out. Now, Ghash wasn't, you know, they weren't trying to do this, right? Like, they were just, like, this wasn't like a malicious attack. And they had to issue a statement because they weren't trying to do this. They just ended up doing a really good job. And that ended up being a little bit too successful. And now they're a huge attack vector. Somebody had hacked Ghash during that period and had that mining pool turn around and attack the network. That would be a terrible, terrible thing. So they started manually, like on their own accord, limiting how many people could log in to limit their own mining pool's hash power to, I think they said it wasn't going to be above 40% of the network hash rate. But basically, though, the stink was so loud and everybody was just like, this is terrible. And suddenly tons of people who didn't realize just how dangerous it was were getting every day they logged into anything about how dangerous it was. There was a huge exodus from that pool. In fact, I don't even think Ghash survived. I think they just died at some point. But their hash rate just plummeted for the next like 6 months or whatever until basically they were obscure. And then I'm pretty sure they shut down. I could be wrong. But in the realm of like a government trying to attack or dominate a mining pool, like we kind of see what happens with that, right? Like mining pools aren't all of that hardware. They are people logging in to the pool. It's thousands and thousands of individual users who can simply log in somewhere else behind a VPN or over Tor. And this would be the most sensible way for the government to try to control mining. And I kind of think both of these episodes are decent little petri dishes of what would result from each type of attack. First, an exodus of miners from the afflicted country and jurisdiction, or if a pool, we're talking about the mass logging out event, so to speak, and the bolstering of those who are mining in the dark, quote unquote. So, for instance, one thing that I think people don't, let's say we did have approved miners, but, you know, you get this premium on quote unquote blacklisted or unofficial transactions. Well, it wouldn't be too terribly hard for quote unquote, you know, the approved miners to add some machines that are mining in the dark on a VPN or over Tor using unregistered hash rate, so to speak. And particularly if it gave them high rewards, but then now they also could not report those rewards because they weren't properly approved. It's also private and tax-free rewards, and you may very well end up in a situation that if the privacy and blacklisted coins continue to work, that they actually end up with a market premium. But, you know, basically the routing around of it would not be a huge, terrible challenge. And I think given enough time, the routing around it would be easier, the tools would be easier, and obviously the incentive grows so fast. The worse the consequences of it gets, the more strongly the incentives to fix it or route around it become. So, and then, you know, they could mine their own privacy mixing transactions in the example of the miners because they are doing their own dark mining. So, and I think Bitcoin really is the only one that could even pull this off effectively at scale. Not that it would be, and that's because of the block size limit and the fact that it can get around all of these network barriers and achieve consensus, and somebody can run it easily over Tor or over a satellite network and not be pushed out from being able to communicate and maintain consensus. So it's not like it would be fun and it would be horribly messy and probably detrimental in the interim, but I think the longer it persisted, the less effective it would be, and the more that some specific jurisdiction that fought against it would essentially pay the price. So think about it, like Iran would undoubtedly be on the do not mine list for the US mining pools, right? But Iran has a huge, massive energy stock, and they're already using, they have an official like mining policy because they're attempting to use it to get around U.S. sanctions. They have publicly stated that this is what they're going to do, and they intend to potentially use this tool for exactly that very thing. So they could deploy the mining for the privacy mixing and blacklisted transactions just to include theirs as part of it. So all of them basically become part of their Bitcoin, quote unquote, the Bitcoin that they mine and they see as legitimate. And even if they're losing money for some period, they could keep it up if it allowed them to get around capital controls, because they have a net positive in paying that cost to get around it. In fact, they already have huge costs in trying to get around it. But we actually saw this sort of during the oil crisis, that their energy, they're able to do this because of the massive amount of energy they have. I guess it was Saudi Arabia, really. But regardless, the oil crisis, we saw Russia and Saudi Arabia take advantage of this. Last year, where oil prices went negative, it's funny, so few people talk about this, but they were still drilling and selling oil and dumping it onto the market to continue to push the price down in an effort to hit the U.S. shale industry, which wasn't going to be able to sustain itself as long as they could at negative prices. So they effectively dealt a huge blow. And you know, this is worsened with Biden's executive orders recently to the U.S. shale industry. And their attempt was to smush the U.S. energy sector. And, you know, who knows what's going to come of that in the future. But I haven't looked back into it, but it's still really crazy story. But this is why that attack vector immediately turns into political game theory, right? Countries are at odds with each other. And the very reason one jurisdiction would want to censor is almost entirely for political reasons and to attack a political opponent. So this is their top concern. This is the thing that they do, their raison d'etre, if you will. So Bitcoin being global and lightweight enough to achieve consensus anywhere in the world and across all borders means they cannot escape having to fight the mining game against the very countries and jurisdictions they are hoping to ban from the network. And as the very economics of the system is designed, and as we have seen in practice, defending the network against such an attack is cheaper than running a persistent attack against the network. Any minor success of the attack, of the underdog, of the minority consensus in this system is essentially wiping out massive amounts of progress for the attacker. If they get in just a few blocks that are too difficult to orphan, it gets exponentially harder for them to undo it, and until the fact that they just have to leave it in. And I don't think this is feasible in the long run, even though I do think it's possible that governments will attempt it. And good God, I've already gone so long on this one. Last thing, though, because I really just want to say something about this. Then there's the 6102 attack, right? Executive Order 6102. This isn't really an attack on Bitcoin. This is an attack on Bitcoiners, right? So the reason the Executive Order 6102 was issued was so the government could acquire an extremely valuable hard asset at their citizens' expense. They were robbing their citizens, right? It was their way of robbing the public of the most relevant and successful value-sustaining asset. If this happened, it would basically be an implicit declaration that Bitcoin is the most valuable and important asset to get your hands on. The scrambling would be insane. And another important note on this is that the price of gold increased when the Executive Order 6102 was put in place. It did not fall. And then the U.S. government effectively set the price after, you know, this had basically unfolded and they got the gold that they needed and did their broad confiscation. They set the price at like nearly double what it had been before. So after they were holding it all, the official price went from like $20 to $35, which was just a beautiful, political weapon to just mass theft across all of society while everybody's in Great Depression, mind you. But the important note is Bitcoin is so much easier to hide and move than gold. And funny enough, it's for the exact same reason that it is easier to get out of the country and remember where you kept 12 gold bricks than it is to get out of the country with 12 gold bricks. The Bitcoin keys are just the information about the value. The information itself is the value. If you admit that it's easier to remember where you put 12 gold bricks than it is to get those 12 gold bricks and get them out of the country, well, then you recognize how much easier it is to get Bitcoin out of the country. While at the same time, the government is essentially announcing to the world that Bitcoin is so critical that they have to confiscate it. And then they immediately become incredibly unfriendly to the Bitcoiners in their jurisdiction. And in doing so, the exodus would be enormous. The very people who would have all the capital to exit the country with the least amount of friction are Bitcoiners. Some political jurisdiction would happily put billboards all the way across the border of their country, like a wall of billboards welcoming Bitcoiners with open arms and no capital gains tax or whatever it would be in an effort to get out from under some larger political opponent's thumb and profit enormously in the process. And the potential alone that this would happen and that they would basically be attacking the very people who could most easily get out from under such an attack could very possibly prevent that attack from ever happening. Because it could be so, it could backfire so badly if they did it, particularly in an era where everybody is already in exodus. Like, the global migration movements that are happening right now are staggering. And that would only make it so, so much worse and put them at risk of, you know, basically, you know, think what's happening with New York and California, the total abandoning of those states, and then the explosion of growth and people moving to Florida and Texas. Think that on a country scale. But this is why another thing Alex brings up is that the hold your own keys mantra remains so important here. Is it's not just the decentralization of the nodes and the consensus mechanism, but also the decentralization of the keys that protect the value itself that helps to keep Bitcoin secure from attack. So if everyone in the US is holding their Bitcoin on Coinbase, Order 6102 is the easiest attack ever. But if everybody is holding keys on their own devices, Executive Order 6102 becomes completely neutered. And this is why if you look at recent statistics and like the Glassnode data or whatever, it's such an awesome development to see a massive exodus of coins from exchange balances right now. This element of Bitcoin is getting stronger very, very quickly. And all of this game theory goes double for Bitcoin companies. And we read CK's excellent piece on the sovereign company thesis. These companies are holding their own keys. And the benefit of a friendly jurisdiction to attract not just Bitcoiners, like as individuals, but huge, wildly profitable, growing, capital accumulating enterprises is orders of magnitude greater than just attracting everyday Bitcoiners. This is how you do more than simply become financially relevant as a jurisdiction, but instead you become the jurisdiction that may very well be the foundation of a new global financial system that literally turns, that makes them the Netflix of the legacy systems blockbuster. And that opportunity will not be passed up. And that's where, as we get into a multi-trillion dollar asset class, that game theory and that struggle and the energy independence of countries becomes far more intertwined with Bitcoin, and where the real beauty of Bitcoin's protocol and economic elements that make it quote unquote money for enemies really come into play in the political sphere. And that's why I think, you know, a lot of that are, you know, my thoughts on why I think governments can't really ban Bitcoin. You know, and I've got a talk on this, the BitBlock Boom talk, An Unstoppable Force. If you haven't listened to that one, this guy's take, like, God bless, I think it was like 35 or something. I don't remember. I'll try to remember to add that in the link if you haven't listened to it. But it's basically about this very idea. My favorite thing that I've heard a couple of people say in different contexts, but I just think this is the framing that makes sense in that context, is that a country cannot ban Bitcoin. All they can do is ban themselves from Bitcoin. And I think that reality gets truer and truer every day that passes and for the longer that Bitcoin survives. So with that, I am out. Thank you guys so much for listening. This was an awesome piece. A huge thank you to Alex Gladstein for this work, and Quillette for hosting the piece. And don't forget to check out the article and follow Alex on Twitter. And much love to our sponsors, the BitBox O2 hardware wallet for your cold storage. Don't get caught in the 6102. Hold your own keys with the BitBox hardware wallet. And then Level.co for mobile banking services. Integrate your financial life with the Bitcoin space. And then lastly, lovely to have them back on board. Swan Bitcoin is the place to auto stack your sats. And you know what they will do? They will auto send your, auto withdraw your coins directly to your BitBox without you having to do anything. All you have to do is set it up. It's beautiful. It's my favorite feature. Check them out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. I love you all. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan. Bitcoin cannot be banned. And until next time, everybody, take it easy. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.